Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Jack Devine's career with the CIA might sound like the stuff of Hollywood blockbusters. He was stationed in Chile when Allende was forced out, played key roles in what would be called Charlie Wilson's War, and in the agency's pursuit of Colombian drug kingpin Pablo Escobar. For a time, he supervised a troubled underling named Aldrich Ames, later discovered to be among the most notorious double agents in American history. All the while, Devine was trying to provide a stable and safe life for his wife and children, and to put his work into the broader context of both shifting global events and human nature. Jack Devine spent 32 years with the CIA, ultimately commanding the agency's Directorate of Operations, which oversees the activity of American covert operatives stationed all over the world, and he says it is mostly nothing like the movies. His new book, written with Vernon Loeb, is called Good Hunting, an American spy master's story. He's in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Jack, welcome to Think.
Good to be here.
Your title, Good Hunting, refers to how you would sign off on classified cables. What do the words actually mean?
Well, I think when I trace it back, the first notice I picked up was Kipling uses it back in the 1800s. And I think the intent is good luck, break a leg. But when you get into the operational world, I think it has more vigor to it. And it means go after bin Laden, go after John, the orange-suited cutthroat, go after Pablo Escobar. So it's the pursuit of people that are inimical to our interest and pursuit of information. And it took me a couple of years to come up with the title. I had a few others, which we could go into. But I was watching an old black and white movie, and as the French partisans were leaving in Nazi Germany, one of the actors said, "Good hunting." And then how many cables did I sign with that? How many times did I receive one? So I thought I think it's a very appropriate title. There's a TV show, Homeland, and I've done some work with them. And it was a little disturbing at one point, Carrie's leaving, and Saul, who had the job as chief of worldwide operations, the job I had in the mid-90s, and he says to Carrie, "Happy hunting." And I thought, oh, my God, you missed the point. It's, you know, it's like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, hi-ho, hi-ho, off to work. We go. Good hunting has a power and thrust behind it, you know, go get them. And that's not what happy hunting sounds like.
Good hunting also implies that there is concern about ethics and propriety and legal status that a lot of people assume that the CIA just sort of runs roughshod over. I got the sense reading this book that a lot more time and energy is spent trying to make sure that what the agency is doing falls within the boundaries of U.S. law.
No, I think that's a really good point, and I think it's one that's badly misunderstood. It's interesting, when you're in the CIA, and again, obviously I'm a partisan perspective on this, on the right-hand side as you walk in, they have the stars of all the fallen CIA officers that have died in the defense of our country. On the other side is a quote from the Bible, and it says, "You shall know the truth, then it'll set you free." And it really should be the mantra of the intelligence collection part, which is, again, a nonpartisan view. It's just get the facts. Don't try and make the president happy or any government official. Your mission here is to hunt for the facts. And in that sense, I do believe there's an ethical dimension to the expression good hunting. One of the other things that's not well understood, in fact, I don't think I had perspective on it for many years. I mean, when you go into the CIA, you're breaking laws all around the world. Now, I quickly would add, with the Justice Department's approval, okay? But that means you can distort information, you can suborn people, but within the context of law. And unspoken is an ethical basis inside the building. You can't use any of those. If you lie, ever get caught lying inside the building, your career is over. If you ever wheel and deal with money, if you're a self-promoter, you might do it clandestinely and keep it to yourself. So there's a duality about the CIA that requires a higher degree of ethics than I think is portrayed in many media presentations of the CIA.
What was your training like, and how was it divided between tradecraft and analysis and things like paramilitary operations?
Well, first I would say it was a lot of fun, but you have to be young. There's a TV show called Naked and Afraid. Now, we were dressed, but it reminded me parts of it where you're in a survival environment. But let me begin at the first part, which is you start with orientation, geopolitical analysis of the world. Various speakers come in, and then they build it up to case studies, spying and the spying world. Then you get around to classroom work, writing reports, who, what, when, where, and how. It's interesting that the career that's closest to being an operations officer, a spy master, if you will, is a journalist, because they have to seek who, what, where, and how, and they have to be persistent. They have to be able to put their foot in the door, not be overly sensitive to that. So I think you learn the writing and the debriefing, how to extract information from people, wittingly and unwittingly. And so you have contrived cocktail sessions and clandestine meetings. You learn how to surveil and to be surveilled. And I always found it interesting that when you're being surveilled, you see the movies where you bend over and you tie your shoe or you look in the window. I mean, please. But there's almost an inner ear. You can feel it. And there's patterns that you take that before long you can see people. And it's a chess game. And today it's much more complicated because you have drones. You have so many other ways to surveil people that they don't have any clue that they're being watched. And then the second part is the paramilitary part. And while a number of our people are very involved in combat and have lost their lives among those stars on the wall, when I was going through, it was you had the Vietnam problem, and a lot of our officers were going out to the Vietnam scene. They wanted to make sure that everybody that went through the training was familiar with every weapon under the sun, and that they knew how to use them. They also gave you demolitions training. That was not my best grade, I would quickly point out, because I was married at the time. I had a couple kids, and I thought, well, a detonating cord burns at a certain speed, so I was always going to I always cut myself a couple extra inches so I could get away from the explosion. The instructors didn't think it was very funny when all the other people on my team would blow something up and mine be 30 seconds later. I think it was prudent, but it's in my file. It says something, whatever you do, don't let this man near explosives. Well, in 1986, I was responsible for more explosives than anybody in the history of the agency, because I was running the war to drive the Russians out of Afghanistan, which required all types of armaments.
Including Stinger missiles. That was the big one, right?
I'm glad you mentioned Stinger, because it falls into sort of the backdrop of the history of Afghanistan. But, I think there's times in history where a single weapon system truly changes history, whether it's gunpowder or planes or aircraft carriers, armor, archery. But the Stinger was so important because we were supplying 125,000 Mujahideen fighters, and that's a huge logistical task. I would say if I were looking at my job, it wasn't James Bond swinging off of a helicopter. Mine was to find trucks and find factories that could produce AK-47s and find mules to haul the weapons over the last, 100 miles in Afghanistan. But in the mid-'80s, 86, there was a decision made to give it one more big try. President Reagan in the White House and Congressman Wright from Texas, he was the Speaker of the House, and believe it or not, in those days they had bipartisan cooperation on key foreign policy issues, and decided they were going to try one more time. And we were having great difficulty moving the weapons across the border because the Russians had the Hind helicopter. It's similar to our Black Hawk, and everything was pinned down. We tried every other weapon system under the sun that could strike airborne platforms. And we've had not introduced any American weapons up to that point, because when you're an insurgency, you want to be able to use the opposition's weapons. And we also didn't want to rub in the face of the Russians that we were supplying American weapons. They knew exactly what was going on, who was on the other side of the mountains. But there's gentleman rules, which there are not today in the terrorism world. But we couldn't move the weapons. They were just bottled up at the border. And finally, I went down to the White House to see a video of the Stinger missile being fired in training. And it was awesome. You fired it to the left and the helicopters to the right. It automatically, heat-seeking, made its own right turn. And on the first day that they were deployed in the field, three helicopters were shot down, September 26th, if I remember, of 86. And we had imagery right away. And I took it up to the director, and he said something like, "I think it's over." And what he meant, not what I understood at the time, was it wasn't we were going to shoot down Soviet helicopters and we were going to keep score. The Russians changed their strategy. They started flying above the range of the Stinger, which meant that all the weapons poured across the border. And it was such a tremendous psychological blow. In other words, they were not going to be able to suppress this. And I believe back in Moscow, their retreat started that day. And I think it was one of the three major considerations that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union, Stinger being one, the collapse of the economy, and frankly, the staleness of communism as a working ideology.
Does it bother you that that is called Charlie Wilson's War by many people? With no disrespect to the congressman.
Charlie, I mean, listen, I consider myself most lucky to have known Charlie. I mean, he's a real character, one of those people in life that you never forget. So he had retired from Congress, and I had retired from the agency and started a new business in New York. And he called one day and he said, "Look, let's have dinner at Sparks Restaurant." Now, I'm not sure how many of your listeners know. Sparks is the steakhouse where Paul Castellano, the mafia don, was, shot right at the doorstep. So that appealed to Charlie's sense of romance. And so we sat down and we had our wives with us, and the drinks came, and he leaned across. He said, "Jack, I know you didn't like the book. You're going to really hate the movie." And the reason we could laugh about it is a very serious point, but it's a good-natured one. Charlie was terribly important in bringing money to the issue. But what I was concerned about is people saw Charlie Wilson and sort of a rogue congressman, and that somehow that's how these things really happen. And that's not how it happens. It happens because the U.S. government, in a bipartisan manner, decides that it's going to amply supply the materials that are needed, that you actually have a group on the ground that's going to fight. And there's a lesson in that as we look at Iraq today, and that you have an agency and you have allies like Pakistan that are prepared to cooperate. So it's a huge government program. It makes for a boring movie and a boring book. So Charlie, I'm grateful because he brought a lot of pizzazz to it. But I just am concerned that those that are practitioners in the business and those that are policymakers never fall into the belief that somehow you can make things happen on the cheap. And we've been in trouble before because we've not looked at problems as gimlet-eyed as we needed to. So that's my issue. And, I'm not suggesting we make a movie along the lines I described. I said it'd be just terribly boring.
We're speaking this hour with Jack Devine. He spent 32 years with the CIA, ultimately commanding the agency's Directorate of Operations. His book is called Good Hunting, an American Spymaster's Story. He's in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the CIA's former Directorate of Operations, Jack Devine. He was with the agency for 32 years. He has written a book called Good Hunting, an American Spymaster's Story. He'll speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think at kera.org. You retired from the CIA in 1998 to start this private strategic intelligence firm, but I know that you've kept a very close eye on everything that's going on. And I want to know, would you say that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have fundamentally changed the scope of what the CIA does and is expected to do?
In the history of CIA, there are periods where covert action, and that's the main theme of the book, is the action part, the James Bond as opposed to the espionage, Smiley, and the Carrés books. So it's the action part. And it's counterintuitive, but most CIA officers that I grew up with want nothing to do with the action part. It really, they want to do the spying part. They don't want to be involved in the action, even though the action requires a great deal of spying. Their wishes aside, the charter that was set up for the CIA, the 1947 charter, says, carry out those special activities as directed by the President of the United States. That's the authority for action. So you had Vietnam, the Bay of Pigs. I mean, I'm just picking some of the more high relief programs, Central America, Afghanistan. So the CIA gets involved in it. The difference, I think, is we've never been at war for so long. So you can run at these programs for 3 or 4 years, and not everybody in the agency is sucked into the program, and you're able to reset. But now we've been fighting a war since 9/11, two wars, and now it's spread into other parts of the Middle East as well. It can't help but over time to create more of a paramilitary culture and having more of your people exposed to it. And it is hard to begin your career in the action part, jumping out of planes and helicopters and doing a lot of tactical things. And then to go back to tackling some of the more traditional targets, whether it's Russia or China or whatever. So I think it does have an impact. And one of the problems is I think the size of the CIA, despite the public perspective, has not really increased very much in terms of its official officers. There's a lot of contracting that goes on. It's not quite the same. Its core people have been drawn into it. And this is not as it's not so much a criticism as an observation and an alert that we need to be mindful of this and need to be making sure that those that are allocating money and positions are making sure that other parts of the world are amply covered.
Many people continue to believe, despite the consensus of the Church Committee, that the CIA had a great deal to do with the overthrow of Salvador Allende. You're adamant here that, in fact, although Nixon did not want him to take office in the first place, the ultimate coup was not an operation of the CIA.
It's just
not aided by the CIA.
It's amazing how deeply etched the fact that CIA overthrew Allende is in the minds of the academic world and much of the intellectual world. And you can, you know, one can argue often about things in CIA and its positions, but the beauty of the Chile thing, which was a great horror to me when it happened, but today I'm grateful for it, is that all the documents have been declassified. Virtually all the documents around it. So people can argue as much as they like, but there's a real frame of reference to turn to. And when the Church Commission was written, I was a very young CIA person. I thought, this is outrageous that the Congress would be reviewing our clandestine operations and writing a report. And today, when I think back on it, I'm a very strong advocate of congressional oversight. And when I reread the report as I was going through the preparation of the book, it's a very good report. And in the end, when one reads the report, it doesn't say that the CIA, it says clearly the CIA did not work with the military, that we roiled the waters. And if I could, the problem, Chris, this is a long thing, I'm sure you're aware on your readers, but there were two parts. One, as you rightfully said, our role was to block Allende from coming to power, even though the chief of station said this was a dismal idea, it wasn't going to work, and bloodshed. The White House decided to give it a try anyway, and it was terrible. It didn't work. But what most people have forgotten is the next day we received a cable, support the party, support the opposition press, try to keep the communists from coming to power, but don't plot with the military. And the way we found out about the plot, which is a matter of record, the cables are in – my cable is in the book. That's the first cable. And I'd like to say I was the one who got the report. I did. My wife got it because the agent couldn't find me. I was out having a lovely Italian lunch in some restaurant in Chile. And he found her and said, look, there's going to – he wasn't a military person. He was very close to the military, but he himself wasn't. He said, look, I'm leaving town. Tell Jack there's going to be a coup in 3 days, and it's going to start in Valparaiso with the Navy. Later in the day, I got a backup report, also not from the military. So CIA only learned about the specific coup via sources that were not in the military. So I think this is all a matter of record, but one can argue about how much did we stir the water up. I believe the end of Allende's economic policies more than anything were such a disaster that he fell of his own weight.
Of course, after him came Pinochet.
Well, it's interesting. The CIA reporting and assessment of Pinochet might not have been our finest hour. They said, oh, he's such a weak reed. He's never going to lead the military into a coup. Got that one wrong. And if someone had asked the consensus of the CIA people operating there, how long do you think the military government's going to stay in power? And by the way, it was September 11th of 73. And I think most people would have said, oh, you know, they'll be here a year, they'll straighten things out a little bit, and then there'll be elections. And I will tell you the opposition party supported the coup because they thought they were going to be back in power. No one had a good fix on the military mindset, which was different than the political mindset. Once it became clear that there were violations of human rights, I mean, let me be more specific, there was torturing and other things, there wasn't much enthusiasm in CIA and certainly not in the U.S. government for Pinochet. And I wrote a memo that I think, unfortunately, I think the chief probably threw it in the trash can. He said, what do you think we should do here now that we got Pinochet? And I said, well, we should use covert action to get rid of him as well. And I think that probably was premature. But he wasn't the darling of the CIA.
You had a wife and five very young children living with you in Santiago when this was all going on. So you have this work to do, you have these responsibilities, but you also, half your heart has to be at the house.
Right. Maybe my head wasn't, but my heart was. I mean, earlier you noted that, you know, how I managed to keep the house together and all. But, you know, I wouldn't pass a polygraph on that ever. I mean, the truth of the matter is my wife held it together, you know. It was probably, if I could just impart one story, it's probably my worst personal decision. I mean, I've made lots of career ones over the years. If you're in the business, you do. But the worst personal one is the country was going through a very tumultuous period. There was they tried to bomb the house next to me. They missed, and it blew off some of the plaster in the back of my house and left a hole in the ground. So it was coming in close. So one afternoon I said, Pat, that's my wife. I said, look, let me show you what we need to do here. I may be stuck in the embassy, which in fact I was for 5 days. I couldn't leave the embassy once the coup started. I said, I could be stuck. So let's move the sofa here about 10 feet from the door. Now put the kids up in the attic. And here's a shotgun. Now, aim at their chest as they come through the door. Of course, you might miss if you aim at their head. And Pat said, well, how do you reload this thing? Now, what's the problem? The fundamental problem, it's a version of madness, is that, you know, if it was that bad, I should have just packed everybody up and left. Now, the truth of the matter is when the coup came, there were people that were killed on the corner. A brave CIA case officer who lived nearby when he heard things falling apart and heard me on the phone talking to my wife, got in the car and grabbed them and the kids, grabbed the kids and Pat and went to their house with a helicopter hovering overhead. So, you know, my only excuse is youth, I guess. And well, there's another important point that I should address. And it's you know, you always defer to the field. You let the field, because they're on the ground. They understand the dynamics in the political situation. They have ground truth, with one exception, and that's in the security arena. And I know a lot of people in the field would disagree with me on that. Because in the field, you think somehow it's all going to work out. And whether it's in Tripoli or Benghazi or whatever, you're on the ground and you're assuming that somehow the militia is going to work, and you know you're young and these things are somehow manageable. And I think the security decisions have to be made back home. And in my case, again, not to look at it through such a narrow funnel, but I was looking at it in the mind of youth that nothing bad can happen to us, can it? And it certainly could.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to John in Royce City. Hi, John.
Hello. I'm concerned that so little credit seems to be given to Massoud for defeating the Soviets, especially after, I believe it was the 6th offensive in the Panjshir Valley. Instead, so many people always give credit to the Stingers. Can you comment on that?
No, Massoud was the most effective tribal leader. In fact, he was so effective that, as you'll recall, right before, a few days before 9/11, he was taken out by bombers. He was the lion of the Panjshir. So, but I would say that Massoud, without American help, would be really have been just one more player on the scene. We supported 125,000 troops on the ground. So the Russians weren't going to leave because of one tiger up in the Panjshir, and they would have gotten them one way or the other. But I want to underscore your point, though. He was the top commander, the one we thought had the most effective fighting effort. He also was a Tajik, as I remember. And, he was a minority, so he was never going to have the support of the entire Mujahideen population.
In your first job with the CIA as a documents analyst, you were a couple of desks away from this guy that you and your colleagues called Rick. You would later directly oversee his work when you were stationed in Rome. It was Aldrich Ames.
Yeah, the book, as I said, is about covert action, but I do weave through it the espionage piece, and it's the betrayal piece. It's such a, however you go back through history and look at the history of intelligence, there's betrayal, and whether it's Kim Philby in Britain or Rick Ames in the United States. And to have known a mole, I went to his wedding, he drinks together, knew his first wife very well, and knew his second wife not so well. But it's troubling for one. And when I first met Rick, and he sat about 10 feet away from me, he didn't care about how he looked. He was a great reader. He was committed to the business. His father was in the business. He and I had a discussion once. He was arguing the key to the business is counterintelligence, finding moles. And I said, no, it's changing the world in covert action. And we traded books. He gave me a book called Coffin for Demetrius, which is a Turkish setting, Eric Ambler, Betrayal Within Betrayal. And I gave him one by Robert Laswell, a pseudo-Freudian book saying if you're weaned on the left, you're going to be liberal, weaned on the right, you're going to be conservative. Basically saying there's a predetermination to it. And what happened, his father was a failure. And Rick had among other traits, there was a certain narcissism there, which you'll see, and we can talk about some of the others today. A narcissism that made him think he was smarter than everybody, and he wasn't. But he had a terrible flaw when you mix that with laziness. And he just didn't work hard. He would only do those things he wanted. And as time went by, his career faltered, and those that were at least as smart as he did worked across a broader spectrum with more energy, and he kept falling further behind. So I think there was a gap between his self view and how the institutions were treating him. And it's in that space that I think is where most betrayals take place.
Because
it's not ideological. It's rarely ideological. It's really how you feel about yourself and the system you're in.
Because the other side will give you that attention you're not getting from your own organization?
Well, I think that's...
That you haven't earned.
I think there's a revenge part, but I think it's also now someday I will be the top mole in the history of the United States, you know. And, you know, you start a controversy. Where does Snowden fit in that same sort of scheme of things? So recognition is really important. Hansen, the other spy who was very famous in that same decade, was with the FBI. We thought he was in CIA or hunting for him all the time. But again, it was his feeling that he was better and smarter and the institution wasn't recognizing it, so he reached out. Ames, on the other hand, thought that he could handle the KGB. And for those that are watching the Americans and think they can handle the KGB, I would encourage you to think twice. So he walked in and thought he would just give them a little information when he walked the American Embassy in Washington. And he walked out. He'd given up the identities of of 11 of our best agents inside the Kremlin. I mean, Russians that worked for us. And they were all executed. And if I could add sort of the last note on Ames, he was being interviewed. He was only interviewed once that I'm aware of on television. It was sort of a bland interview for a while. And then the interviewer, the woman, said to him, "Well, Rick, did you have any trouble sleeping at night?" And without, you know, perhaps a microsecond of hesitation, he said, "You know, I thought I would, but no, I didn't." And there you have a sociopath. I mean, someone who could see the results of his work in the death of 11 individuals and not bat an eye, has deep-seated psychological issues.
We're speaking this hour with Jack Devine. He spent 32 years with the CIA, ultimately commanding the agency's Directorate of Operations. He's author of a book called Good Hunting, an American Spymaster Story. He's in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the former commander of the Directorate of Operations of the CIA, Jack Devine. His new book is called Good Hunting, an American Spymaster Story. He'll speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jack, when you finally have confirmation that for extended periods of time you had, among you and your colleagues, someone who was this horrendous traitor, I wonder if you have to fight off a sort of renewed and inappropriate sense of paranoia about everyone else around you and every other strange thing you observed in a colleague and something that irritated you or caused you to sort of perk up your ears.
Rick wasn't all wrong on the counterintelligence piece, and there was an overreaction in the mid-70s. This is, again, long story where James Angleton is a very famous spy spy master in the counterintelligence world, and he knew Philby, and then he became, I'm not a psychiatrist, but had looked like traits that were, he was suspicious of everybody in the CIA. And then there was a reaction to it so that when he left, they sort of broke that discipline down. And I think as a result of that, people started to think less about that possibility. After Ames was apprehended, there were folks in the agency that were promoting a badge, and the badge had never again on it. You know, I refused to wear it. And there are two reasons. One, it's the business. you know, we recruit Russians. Why would we not for a moment think that they wouldn't have a successful recruitment? And history would point to it. But there was a group that somehow, a large group of people felt, you know, maybe if we have better records keeping and better testing and whatever. And they didn't, I don't think they appreciated the type of business we were in that context. But I also had a piece of information that virtually none of them had, and that was when Ames gave up the 11, it didn't explain the loss of a few others. And that meant we had another one somewhere in the midst. And for the longest time, we thought it was another Rick Ames inside a CIA. We went hunting for him. We had a number of FBI people inside the building, with people didn't know they were FBI, working to try and find Hansen. And at the end of the day, it turns out he was in the FBI. So never again is a bad way to think about it. And, you know, you can't live in a constant state of paranoia, but a little of it's helpful.
So how do you frame someone like Snowden, Edward Snowden?
Well, I wrote an article in Politico when Greenwald's book came out. They called and said, well, Greenwald, what do you think? So I wrote a piece, and I sort of stand by it. I don't think – I know there's people that think he was recruited in a Russian spy or whatever ahead of time. I don't believe that. I have high regard for the KGB or the SVR, as it's called today. But that's too good, you know. So I don't think he was a Russian agent. But I think he had the same traits that Rick Ames had, and that was he thought he was smarter than everybody, but he was dropped out of school, you know, didn't apply himself. I think there are issues about how he viewed himself and the system, and it's in that space. But I will tell you that once you – the fact, once you go to China, you go to Russia, you're going to live there. And I know there's commentary about him coming back. It's never going to happen because he's going to go to jail, and he knows that because he knows what he gave up. You can't have a meal. You can't have an apartment. There's nothing you can do in the Soviet Union that you are not beholden to the system. So whether you're witting or unwitting about the reality of your situation, you're a pawn in the system. When the Russians feel it's inconvenient to have him talk, he won't be talking. You know, and right now they don't need to give him a script because everything he says is prejudicial to the national security interests. So they let him run with the script, but he may feel – and he's getting the attention that he would like, just like Rick Ames. And Hansen would love to have had the attention and not go to jail.
Are there things that Snowden revealed that the American public had a right to know?
Well, I think, you know, as I said, I'm a big advocate of congressional oversight. And the reason I'm an advocate is, you know, we have a democratic system in which it's a very tricky business having a secret intelligence. It's almost non-American. Let's just start to go back and read history. You know, they have a show called Turn where George Washington, it's all quite – I mean, George Washington spy network and the Civil War. I mean, we've always had spies. It's part of statecraft, whether it's Henry VIII or whatever. It's just, very much a part of the business. So how do you make it work? You make it work because you have people that are elected by the people, the American people, and their main interest is to be reelected and to satisfy that constituency. No matter how much we like or dislike different congressmen, they do that. So they tend to be very conscious of what is saleable in their own constituencies. And that's why I'm big on briefing Congress on what you're doing. And they were briefed, extensively briefed on what NSA was doing and proved it. I mean, so there's no surprises. And I've yet to see someone stand up in any of the committees and say, oh, I didn't know that NSA was collecting megadata or whatever. So it's your best check on the system. And what's happening today, why I'm uncomfortable with it, the Patriot Act is up for debate because it's going to expire. And you have the vast majority of the House saying, yeah, we're going to take away some of the authorities that the NSA has right now and the intelligence community and law enforcement world. And I'm assuming they're reflecting the American people's view. So, coming back to it, if you say what is it that Snowden presented to the American people, I think we talk about privacy in your government. It's sort of it's a pressure point. It sort of hits a point. But you sit around and say, well, wait a minute. Walmart has more about it, cares more about your taste and interest than the CIA ever, and NSA would ever care. Now we're talking about handing over all the megadata to the private enterprise. And I would just say for all the years I was in government, I mean, there were strict rules and regulations and oversight. There was no monetary consideration. And I don't know how this is going to work. And with all due respect to what I just said about the congressman, I hope they know what they're talking about because it makes me feel uncomfortable. The private sector is our interest on this one. I don't see how it's going to run faster, more effectively. And I'm worried we're going to lose some capability.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Robert on the line in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Thank you. Well, to follow up on your last discussion, you just mentioned days of bipartisan support in Afghanistan. Are you aware of any particularly operations that were objectively a good thing to pursue but were frustrated just due to politics, say one side didn't want to let the other side get credit for it?
I hesitate just simply because it doesn't, none comes to mind. One of the things I think is important for me to stress, and if people just ask me the question, what is the most misunderstood thing about the CIA? I would say that people don't realize that it's not a rogue institution, that it is not a policy group. It follows the directions of the president. So the CIA, and when it's reflecting on this point, it isn't its job to be to be frustrated. The American people elect the president; he's going to be held accountable. The CIA's job is to execute. But we're human beings, so I'm sure we've felt frustrated. I think I alluded earlier that sometimes with the play out of history, maybe some of those frustrations weren't as worthwhile as you think, at least in my case. Some of the things I was frustrated with early on, as time went by, I began to think that, limitations, restraint. In the book, I talk about when you use force and when you don't. Restraint is as big a characteristic as action. The CIA has a can-do attitude, and you have to be very careful about that. But it's the restraint that is equally important. Where the CIA, where the U.S. government gets itself in trouble is when expediency becomes the top priority and you decide, look, let's not cut Congress in. Let's not brief the Secretary of State. Let's not brief the – I'm pointing to examples where these things go really bad. Let's just go do it. We get it done in a hurry. Almost without exception, they end up in the trash heap of history. So I just say to my fellow colleagues, toughen up, live with some frustration.
What's the postmortem like after an operation, either a successful one or one that has not achieved the objectives?
Well, lessons learned. There's a bottom line there. It's pretty conspicuous that it failed. Let's say if the operation had failed in Bin Laden, the whole world would have seen it unfold, and then there'd be no doubt there'd be second guessing the next day. Why didn't you just bomb it? But part of that training that you raised at the very beginning, Chris, is to walk you through the lessons and to learn how to evaluate what went wrong and try not to make that mistake again. And training, and it's called tradecraft, the business I was in. And I like the word because it's like an apprentice working for a journeyman. I mean, I had the classroom work, but the biggest learning took place at the knee of professionals that I had high regard for. I was lucky to work for a number of really highly talented professionals.
You were working in a field where it's often not an advantage to stand out in a crowd. We should say to people, you're a 6-foot, 5-inch tall white guy, and you worked in many parts of the world where there weren't too many of those around. Did you learn certain ways to cause yourself to somehow be less visible than you would be otherwise?
Well, I have this to less attract step that I can take. I have in the book a picture of me, and if you saw the movie American Hustle, it's like the long hair, the mustache. there's plaid pants. Better part of judgment. I didn't put in color because they're yellow. You know? So, and the reason is this private joke between myself and the book, and that is, how could you possibly spy and look like that? The point is, spying takes place with a sleight of hand. It's when you're in those pockets of not being visible. It's doing what looks natural and really isn't natural. So it doesn't matter whether you're tall or short, fat, round. It's the trade that you learn how to operate in the context of it. When I was finishing training in this regard, I thought, well, I'll go to Russia. I thought that's where it took place. Problem with Russia is the KGB is on you all the time, so you don't get out and mix it up as much. It's a different kind of thing, and I think I would have been far less happy. But when I was finishing, the counselor said, oh, no, you're too tall for Russia. And I didn't know any better, so he said, okay, I'm too tall, I guess. So he took me over to the Latin American division, and that's how I ended up in Chile. But you stop and think, wait a minute, I'm too tall for Russia, but it's okay for me to be in Latin America. And it later turned out that he was recruiting for Latin America. But it was a blessing because I ended up in a place where, there were two major spots in the world. One was Vietnam, the other was Chile in terms of U.S. policy interest in those days. And I was lucky to be in that one.
I know you do have quarrels with a lot of the portrayals that Hollywood has of the agency that you worked for 3 decades. But I wonder if you have a favorite just as a viewer, as a fan of entertainment.
Well, I should say Homeland
because they pay you.
But the one that I find intriguing is Jason Bourne, The Bourne Identity. Mm-hmm. And the reason is the first time when you see it, you say, look, we have all that technology, right? But it's not integrated. In other words, you can't have it all working as smoothly as it does in the movie. But then you fast forward 15 years, and it is integrated. So I cut Hollywood more slack today than I did when I was in my career, because in many ways they educate the public. And I think the American people really do understand where it's exaggerated for effect. Zero Dark Thirty. No, Argo is the one I was thinking of. There were American diplomats that were in the Canadian embassy that had to be ushered out of Tehran after the embassy was seized. And Tony Menendez, the CIA fellow, went in and provided them with the documents and the training. And they left and went through the airport and got on a plane. Now, in the movie, they have people shooting at them. The truth is that didn't happen, but shooting at them portrayed how you really felt. In other words, you can't get that unless you have some of those dramatic things, but they were in a life-threatening moment. It's hard to catch.
Jack Devine spent 32 years with the CIA, ultimately commanding the Directorate of Operations. His new book is called Good Hunting, an American Spy Master's Story. He'll speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight. Jack, thank you so much for being with us.
It was great being with you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.